and welcome, my fellow brothers and sisters of Europe, the West, and wherever you are, if you share our concerns. We do have people from all over the world listening to this program that also can see what is happening in the countries that have been built and established by the European stock, and that our concerns and reasons for wanting to fight back are legitimate and would be, well, frankly, completely natural and understandable if they were happening to anyone in another part of the world. It's not the only issue that we speak about on this program, but it is, in our view, one of the most important and pressing issues that we face right now. Not only for personal reasons, being from an occupied Scandinavian country myself, but frankly, too few address something of this magnitude and scale while trying to pretend that it's all fine and just going to sort itself out one day. But we also talk about health, subversion and corruption, plans and agendas of the hostile elites. We also discuss how to fight degeneracy, cultural Marxism, feminism, and try to instead highlight the positive aspects of our heritage and history in order to lift us up where so many are trying to beat us down into guilt and shame, which isn't really working anymore. If you want to find out more, check out our archives at redicecreations.com for more radio videos, inside episodes, and news. By the way, I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and we say thank you to everyone tuning in, whether you're a regular listener or just tuning in for the first time. It's good to have you with us. Today on Red Eyes Radio, we have Daniel Carlsen, the leader of the Party of the Danes, or Danskernes Parti. He was born in 1990, a young gentleman who has his whole life ahead of him. He graduated from high school in 2009. In the period between August 2009 and April 2010, he served his military time as a royal lifeguard, protecting the Danish castles and the royal family. In 2012, Daniel got an academy profession degree in marketing management. And despite his young age, he's already had several years of political experience, and he was one of the initiators of the Party of the Danes. Welcome, Daniel. Thank you so much for being here. I know you're busy with all the politicking that you're involved in, so we appreciate you taking some time speaking with us here today.
Thank you.
Very good to have you here. I have a lot of questions for you and a lot of things I want to ask you about when it comes to Denmark, the state of Denmark, what is happening, and if things are as bad they are pretty much as they are in Sweden. I think we have a lot in common, of course, but maybe I believe there are some things that differ quite a bit. So it'd be interesting to hear more about that. But before we get started, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in politics and how you came to go about this route?
Yeah, I've been a political activist since I was 16 years old. So that's basically for 10 years now. And yeah, how did it get started? that's always the big question. I think it got started when my opinions started to evolve when I went to 7th or 8th grade in school and were starting to get a little interested in politics and so on. But before that, I went to another school and in the early grades, and that school was quite multicultural, so to speak. In the beginning, when I started there in 1996, there was about, that's not official numbers, but that's the numbers that I remember that was talking every people talked about, and it seems quite fair to me that they should be correct. But around 30% of the pupils in the school was immigrants, mostly Muslims.
Yeah.
And 4 years later, when my liberal parents took me out of the school because there was too many immigrants.
Oh, they did, huh? That's
interesting. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. It's always like that with liberals.
Yeah.
They don't like it when it's in their own backyard.
It's not.
Yeah. But then there was about around 50% immigrants. And today, the latest numbers I have heard is that there are more than 85%. So, yeah, it's in a timeline of 20 years, there has happened quite a lot in that school. But when I began to get interested in politics around 7th or 8th grade, my views was not based on because I was very, very interested in immigration policies and so on. But it was never based on, opposition against certain immigrants, because I had a real good social relationship with many immigrants in the school, in the multicultural school I attended to. But I made a lot of thoughts about the demographic situation. Maybe I was not very aware of it already at that point, but I thought a lot about what was really going on, because in such a short time, so many immigrants was actually taking over a school, a whole community, in a really short time. And that made me think. And at first I got, when I got started with politics, I became a member of Danish People's Party, the Populist Party, when I was around 15, I think. But I was only a member for 1 year. Then the membership was not renewed. But they did not really catch my interest. I was not ideological or anything at that time, but I wanted more. I wanted the more radical line and the more consequent line, and again, not based on private problems with the immigrants or something like that, not mm-hmm. at all, but yeah. But more like the thing I was against was not really the criminal immigrants. Because I knew a lot of people like that. The thing I was against was this change of the demographics. That was the problematic thing for me. That has always been the problematic thing in my view. And Danish People's Party and other populist parties in Europe today are not talking about that in the right way, because they don't recognize the Danes, the Europeans, as a certain ethnic group. Right. And that was the problem for me, and therefore I needed to move on. So that was kind of the start, and I have quite a story since that. I was in the nationalist movement for a few years, when I was 16 to 18, different nationalist groups, and then since I was 18, when I was 18, I joined the National Socialist Movement in Denmark, because they were. There was a National Socialist organization, and they were really the only organization in Denmark talking about repatriation of non-Europeans. Yeah. And that was a key point for me and very important. So therefore, I joined them. And 3 years later, in 2011, we were... Some guys from the National Socialist Movement, we left the movement. There was, we have been talking about making a new and more, let's say, modern nationalist movement for quite some time. And we wanted to go on with that. So we left the National Socialist Movement and built our own party, Danskernes Parti, Party of the Danes. In 2011 in the summer, and since then I have been the party leader of that party.
Very good. So it's basically we hear from our fellow Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, whatever detractors all the time. They want to project upon us that we come from a position of hatred of others simply because they have a different color on their skin. Right. That's the straw man that they put upon us, but. Yeah. Explain that a bit more for us in terms of it's basically then the replacement of the native population that you inherently have, that you feel that you have against, right? That is a huge worry issue for you. And so you said that, for example, the Danish People's Party, they don't recognize the Danes as a as an ethnic group, even.
No, no, that's true. And first of all, I must comment on that, because that's very important, and that's quite correct what you say, that we should have some hatred against people based on the color of their skin. But it's very important for me to underline or to emphasize that the color of the skin is, yes, it is indeed a difference between Europeans and other other people, Africans, Asians, and so on, but it is really the smallest difference between us as different ethnic groups, and that's quite the center of the of this discussion. That's is why should we even bother if the only difference was the color of the skin? It right. is not. Yep. We are really different people, and that is the problem. For example, with Danish People's Party, they only see the color, and that is really what we are accused about often. That we only see the color, and therefore we say that those people cannot be here because they have another color of the skin, and so on. But it's really our opponents who only see the color, because there yep. are so much more to different ethnic groups than the color of the skin.
Of course. Yep.
For me, it doesn't matter. it is all the other things that matters, and basically, I respect each people for their. You know, they're who they are, what they are, and I respect their right to their own countries, to their own continents, as well as I demand that the Europeans must have Europe as their continent, and we must have our own nations as European peoples. People.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Of course, and yeah. So we're talking about. Everything from behavior to religion to culture to crime, different attitudes towards freedom of speech and freedom of the press, etc. These are, as many others have pointed out, in many cases we're talking about incompatible cultures, right? That's why we're seeing the heightened conflicts that we're doing right now. And obviously we have the same situation in Sweden when it comes to this, that we had a situation where it was very peaceful, it was very... organized, a very functioning society. Have you seen the same type of transformation in Denmark as I'm sure you've read about in terms of what we are experiencing in Sweden right now with a radical change of our country quickly like this?
Yeah, we have seen it as I told you about it initially. I have experienced it myself, of course, in the school I attended to. As I said, I did not have social problems with the immigrants or anything like that. But there were, of course, general problems. For example, most of the parents who took their kids out of school, that Danish kids out of school, was doing it because they were saying that the environment for teaching and so on was not very good, and that was really the case. Especially, yeah. I believe, because there was this the many different groups, and even within the many immigrants, and they were almost all Muslims, but there were ranks. You know, there was they were Somalis was together, and Lebanese was together, and Turks was together, and so on. So, I've experienced myself, but it's also in general in Denmark where we have these problems. We have ghettos with almost only non-Europeans living there in every major city in Denmark. We have parallel societies. In 2011, there was in one of the biggest Danish newspapers a report on how these different ghettos functions. And it was said that in all of the major ghettos, there was some kind of Sharia law, not only in in, you know, in theory, but also in practice. It was practiced. First of all, as we see in many of such areas around in Europe, police and fire department and so on cannot get inside these areas when they want to, because there will be thrown stone, Molotov cocktails and so on at them. But they had their own juridical system. They have their own juridical system in some extent in some of these ghettos in Denmark. So it is like that. I know we you hear a lot about Denmark in the news all the time. We have such a strict policy towards immigrants and so on. But it's really not the case. We have a lot of strict symbolic politics, but we don't really have you know, strict immigration policies. And if I may give an example, we have had a case recently with this with seizing of jewelries from asylum seekers. Yeah,
it's practically the Holocaust all over again, right?
Yes, oh, yes, it is indeed the Holocaust. Yeah. in many ways, and but it was so, you know, in everyone was talking about it. People were making comparisons with Holocaust and everything, and it was so awful. First of all, the law, the content of the law is really, it's not really a law against asylum seekers. It's really a law of equality, so to speak, between asylum seekers and Danish inhabitants. Because when you live in Denmark and you need to have social security, you cannot own more than 10,000 Danish crowns. That's around 2,000 US dollars, a little bit more, a little bit less, sorry. Then this new law made it, you know, possible for Danish authorities also to take valuables from asylum seekers, because they want social help in Denmark. If they did not want social help, yeah, then they could keep their belongings.
Yep.
But if Danish people want social help, they also need to sell their valuables before they can get social help. So basically, the law is about equality.
That's right.
So
and is it funny that they react to this, like when all of a sudden it's enforcement of equality, and they get their, well, they get their panties in a wad, as they say, right? It's amazing. Yeah, because obviously you have a more sound approach, I would say, to some of these issues, as opposed to, you know, Sweden, which is just, I mean, it's just unspeakable. It's absurd. But does Denmark really enforce them? Have they been actually enforced the way they are said to have been enforced?
But that was actually my second point, and maybe the most important point of this law, because it is really only symbolic. Okay, maybe they do it. We have not really heard so much about it. It was just recently really accepted by the parliament. It's difficult to say how much they have actually how many jewelries they have seized, but I don't think that is the point. This shitstorm, so-called shitstorm, that came after the discussions of the law in the parliament, and after the acceptance of the law by a majority in the parliament, I think that this shitstorm, that the government saw that shitstorm coming, and that they wanted this shitstorm, because we have like that climate in Denmark where people actually support such things, or support what can I say, support that you do something against this invasion that are coming. And I think that the government saw this as an opportunity to do something that would really get huge media attention. I'm sure that they knew this was coming. Of course they knew. They are not stupid. And they wanted to have it to show, or to make people believe that they are actually doing something to stop this this invasion. And it's quite easy. It's a highly symbolic law. It doesn't change anything, not really. But people think that they are doing something, and that's quite the same that Danish People's Party have done for some years. For example, in 2011, 2000 I don't remember the exact year,
right?
But I think it was 2011. They had reinforced border control, so-called border control, but it was not really border control. It was less border control that we have to than we have today. We made some tests at the border where we disguised one of our members as a terrorist and smuggled him over the border quite easily. We made a video of that, that was, you know, their big victory. But in 2011, then there was a change of government. In the past 10 years before that, from 2001 until 2011, the Danish People's Party had supported a government that gave citizenships to more than 83,000 non-Europeans. 83,000 non-Europeans, that's quite a lot,
yeah,
in a land of 5.6 million inhabitants.
Yeah.
Also, they supported this government that made a record high allowed a record high immigration to Denmark in 2008. All these things that really counts, people who get citizenships of non-Europeans, how big the immigration is, and so on. They are not doing anything against that, but they are doing a lot of symbolic acts, and that's really what Denmark is about, Danish politics is about, to say it shortly. We have a very free discussion climate.
Yes.
We can say a lot of things.
Yeah.
And there is a whole nother climate than if you compare to, for example, Sweden, which is totally extreme.
Yeah.
But the things are not really that different, again, when it comes to numbers.
Exactly. That was my perception of it as well. That is like, initially I was like, whoa, they're doing some stuff in Denmark. It's much, much better. They can talk about this stuff. But it seemed, when I looked at, you know, the details closer, it's almost like, wait a minute, they're getting, the appearances are different, but at the end result are very similar. That was my perception.
Yeah. You were quite correct.
Well, what a damn shame, huh? Because I thought at least one Scandinavian country had their wits about them, but I guess not. So, by the way, if you don't mind me asking that, you talked about your upbringing and school and all that. Was it a suburb in Copenhagen, or where were you in Denmark?
I was raised in Aarhus. That's the Aarhus. That's the second biggest town of Denmark, in Jutland, in the center eastern part of Jutland. And I have lived there through almost all of my life. Only had a few jumps off in 2009, and in 1 year I lived in Copenhagen when I was doing my military service, and then I lived some years in another city close to Aarhus, actually, for some years for studying, but that's about it. I was raised and born in Aarhus.
Very good. Now, what else would you like to say about the climate in Denmark and what's going on, to someone who's, I have a lot of kind of more specific questions, but let's just talk about the overview a little bit for someone that isn't too familiar with Denmark in terms of what's going on right now with the immigration issue and how hard things are being hit in Denmark. What would you say to them so they can get a better idea of what's happening?
Yeah, I think to get an idea of how things are in Denmark, I believe, for me at least, the numbers are good. What we know, the official statistics we have in Denmark shows that there are 450,000 non-Westerners. It is in Denmark. That's both immigrants and the children of the immigrants and so on. That's the official numbers, and there are always problems with official numbers. For example, if one non-Western immigrant have a Danish citizenship, then the child of this immigrant, no matter if he will have his child with another non-Western Danish citizenship or not, the child will always be considered as Danish in the statistics.
Right.
And as I said, in the 10 years when we have had a government supported by the populists, some even say nationalists, but that is really not the case, Danish People's Party, we had more than 83,000 that had Danish citizenships. So the number are much higher in reality. I would say that I do not believe that we have less than 800,000 non-Europeans in Denmark.
That's almost, that's over 15%. Then that's
we are 5.6 million inhabitants in Denmark right now. So yeah, it is quite a lot. Yeah, for a small country as Denmark.
Yep, that's right. And isn't that funny though? I mean, we talk about that all the time on this show, but it's funny how, you know, they scream diversity, they scream you know, protection rights for minorities and all this stuff. But I mean, Christ's sake, on a global scale, the Danes, it's a tiny percentage of the global population. You guys are a minority. Swedes are even minority. The fact that we are almost double your population, you know? And there's never any recognition of the fact that we have a culture, we have a heritage, we have our interests, we have things that we're, you know, need to take care of and preserve and all these kinds of issues. But it's just, it never arises on most people's radar for some reason.
No, and it's always like that. And we actually always or often try in our party to approach this line also about you know, diversity, global diversity. I actually believe that we nationalists, as the the only ones in the among all political views today, nationalism is the only political view, world view that really accept and respects diversity, global diversity, real global diversity with different people, different ethnicities, different cultures, and so on. And it is really, you know, rubbish to say that you respect something like diversity and then you just want to mix everything up, because we don't really have much diversity when we are getting overrun in all of Western Europe and all of Europe with time. And that's, I think that's also, you know, quite an important issue to raise. Because we are always talking about Western Europe being overrun and Eastern Europe may be our chance and so on, but I think that there are bigger forces than us who are working on another direction for that.
Absolutely.
For example, in Lithuania, there was a new law implemented in 2014. Due to European Union regulations that made it by law, then now they had to pay more to asylum seekers than they can pay to the old people, that makes it, of course, more attractive for asylum seekers, for migrants, and so on, to come to these countries as well, because they can get the same as they maybe can get in Sweden and Denmark and elsewhere in the western part of Europe. Right now, of course, we don't see it so much in these countries because they are also doing things to protect themselves. We see that, for example, in Poland and so on, and in Hungary. But I think that there are really quite strong forces in, for example, the European Union that works on that that also the Eastern European countries needs to be diversified. I don't even want to use that word because it's so damn wrong. But that they want these countries to be overrun as well by migrants, and that is quite problematic. I don't think that we really, if we don't manage to stop this development in all European countries, or at least in some European countries where we can raise the flag, and that's especially have to be done in the Western European countries which are in decay right now. If we don't manage to do that, then we'll have no chance in the rest of Europe. That will be impossible. I'm really convinced about that.
Yeah, it is a, in that regard, it is a pan-European effort that has to be pulled together here. I mean, we do have the structure of the European Union in place, which is a good tool to work with. Unfortunately, though, as European Union stand today, they are the ones who actually are forcing a lot of these countries to against their will to take in asylum seekers. We had, for example, with us a politician from Estonia, Kristina Ujuland, and she actually spoke quite a bit about how the European Union had pressured them also to, like, you must take immigrants, and no one in the country wanted it. They're dirt poor, pretty much, most of them. They can't afford these things, and despite that, they're being forced. So this is a top-down decision. I think if there was a referendum, if people got a chance to vote on this issue, I think it would be pretty clear. I think we would have probably 70-80% would probably say, no, we don't want it. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree, and that's quite symptomatic for the situation of this immigration and also a lot of European Union issues in general. We have never had referendums about this. The people were never asked because it's not as easy to bribe the people as it is to bribe politicians. And politicians in all Western European countries have indeed been bribed by big international institutions, European Union, NATO, United Nations, and so on. And it's important for politicians to have a good relationship to them, to these institutions, while they that is good for their so-called career, so it has been easier for these institutions to go directly through the politicians, and then they did not need to ask the people, and that is really really problematic that they have enforced all of this so easily upon us. But yeah, we need to do something today, and I agree with you. We need a pan-European alternative and a pan-European resistance, because it's really about all of Europe today.
Well, look at, I mean, Germany is screwing it up for everyone. Through the Schengen zone, many of these people are coming into Germany. They can practically go into whatever country they want to, at least in northwestern and western Europe right now. As you said, some Eastern European countries, they are building little fences, they're trying to control it in some way, but largely these people can move wherever they want, so it's dangerous. I mean, think about it. There was even an article actually a while back, try to confirm it, trying to find the right sources for it. It was a little bit difficult, unfortunately, but there was a speculation regarding one of the Muslim parties in Denmark that basically said, well, Denmark might become the first Muslim country in Europe because of its small population. So if Turkey, for example, joins in the European Union, you could see a mass migration of Muslim Turks up to Denmark, and they'll use the democratic process to convert the whole country into like a Sharia zone or something like that. It's possible, right?
Yeah, it is possible, and they also use these kind of methods, democratic methods in small scale. For example, we have seen examples of that in housing areas, certain housing areas where it has not even been ghettos or anything like that. It has been, with a minority, a real minority, maybe 5-10% of Muslims living there. But they have, even though, managed to get a majority in, for example, the board of the housing area, and then they have banned, for example, Christmas trees in the area and so on. That is a reality in Denmark. They have done the same in local football clubs and so on. So they work in that way. So it's not unrealistic at all. But I also think, you know, about all this, when people see things like that, and when people see what is happening in Cologne, in Paris, and so on. In many years, nationalists all over Europe have said, you know, people just need to see the consequences of multiculturalism. Then they will stand up and fight. But I don't really think that's the case. I don't think it anymore, at least.
Really?
Because we, I think we see another development. I think we see that people are getting used to see all of this, and we also see, for example, what you said, Merkel and Germany has allowed all this to happen. The European Union has allowed all this to happen. The migration to Europe and so on are just going on, and everyone are saying, almost everyone, only a few nationalists regarded by everyone, all other politicians than ourselves, we are being regarded as lunatics, crazies,
yeah,
conspiracy theorists, Nazis, racists, so on. So basically, basement people. And but all the other people, the politicians and so on, NGOs are saying, yeah, we can do nothing to stop this development. We need to discuss how we manage it. And that's that's quite problematic, because I think that a lot of people are actually believing in this bullshit, and it is indeed bullshit. We could have done a lot of things to stop that. It's quite easy, but also, you know, inside the rules of the different conventions, even with EU European Union regulation in hand, we could have stopped this. At least this migration crisis that we are having right now, we could have stopped that easily. The last 5 months, I've been working, I have been having my internship during my education. I have had 5 months internship at Udo Vogt, and he's a member of the European Parliament for the German Nationalist Party, NPD. And I have had my internship there, and I have, among other things, worked with, you know, how we solve this current migration crisis. And one of the things, and I think it's quite interesting, and it really proves an important point. It is that we could actually have solved all of this with EU regulation. We could have stopped the migration. We have this these Dublin regulations, which says that all asylum seekers must have their application processed in the first country of arrival.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, I would think it would be very wrong for us to say, okay, then they must all have their application processed in Greece and Italy and so on. That would be rubbish, and so that is would not be a good idea to do that, because that's still inside Europe. An important thing is that the European Union and its member countries is not the only one who can adapt to these rules. For example, there have been so-called association with agreements with non-member states about these regulations. And that is Iceland and Norway. They are European countries, but association agreements can also be made with non-European countries. We have, for example, had discussions, should Turkey be a part of the European Union, and they are not a non-European country. So it would not be a problem to make association agreements that would be totally within the rules with non-European countries. And that would be Turkey, Morocco, Libya, who would be interesting for the European Union to make association agreements with. Because then all the migrants, not basically, but actually all the migrants who are coming right now, would be with EU regulation in hand. And of course, if you also actually make these regulations work. But if you do so, you could, with EU regulation in hand, say, if you made such agreements, of course, you could say, yeah, we need to ship you all back to these countries.
Right. So
we could actually do things within the European Union. And it's not because that I want to stay in the European Union and so on. And I think all these, laws and so on should be burned, and we should make new ones. So that is not really, I'm not discussing it because I think it's important to stick to these rules. I think it's rubbish.
Yep.
We could stop it much easier, you know.
We got to be smart here, right? That's the point. We got to be smart and use what we have to our advantage here, right? So
yeah, but also because, you know, it's actually more to emphasize that this is not because we cannot do anything, because all people in the European Union, all people in national parliaments all over Europe are saying, we cannot do anything. We are part of the European Union. We must do this. We must do that. But that's bullshit. We could do it within the European Union. We could say, we are going to stop this. It would be easy.
Yeah.
We just need the political will. And that is really the question. We need the will. And if we could just, you know, have that will, and that begins indeed among our people. They have to vote for alternative parties, for nationalists. They have to support nationalists in the local communities. They have to engage themselves and organize themselves. Then we could really make things happen. Also within the European Union, we could also, you know, change it. We just say, okay, fuck the European Union. We make our own laws and we just stop the immigrants at the Mediterranean Sea. That's no problem either. But it's just to emphasize that we could actually do something even within the European Union. And when that is even possible within the European Union, which is maybe the worst thing that has maybe not happened, but at least developed within in modern time in Europe, then everything is possible. And I think that is one key point to emphasize, because I think that if we are going to change anything, we have to stress to all people that there exists hope. There exists really a possibility to change things. And that's so important. And if they first start to believe that again, then I think we can change things.
Well, exactly. Very good point. Because I do feel that many do kind of, they hang their head and it feels like they've, in almost certain aspects, given up, right? I mean, we're still a majority within our own countries here. Come on, yet there's a defeatist attitude. And I just wonder where that comes from, that it's like it seems like such an impossibility. But I mean, let's just think about how things were before. For some reason, more or less, the border has worked in Italy and Greece and Spain and you know, the French side that borders towards the Mediterranean, etc. But then all of a sudden it was just like, you know, one day it snapped and then everyone just kept pouring in. You know, it's just, it's strange. It's like the air has gone out of the European population or something. I don't know how to describe it. Strange.
Yeah, but I also think I think it's very, very interesting what has happened, because it is really from one day to another. Okay, we have always had these migrants and asylum seekers and so on, and really when it began last year, began to be reported
escalate
about in the media and so on. Yeah, when it escalated. Yes, that's more correct to say. Then I also thought actually that, we have seen this in a long time. Now they are calling themselves refugees. Before they were calling themselves we are coming here to work or etc. That was really not the case. I think that in the beginning we saw a lot of people, because due to the situation in Syria and we can always discuss, are these really refugees? And if they are refugees, who are they fleeing from? Are they fleeing from Assad? Then they are probably terrorists. If we need more to discuss that, who are these people who are coming to Europe? Then we know that, I don't know, but I think that maybe in the beginning people from Syria were coming. But we know for a fact that now that's European Union numbers. only 20% of the migrants who actually come here are from Syria.
Is it even that high? I've actually heard lower numbers than that, but yeah. All right, let's take their numbers then. Yeah.
That's from last year, official European Union numbers.
Right.
I'm sure that the number could very well be lower, but that's the official number, European Union numbers I know from the end of last year. Mm. And from that, we can see that this are not due to a conflict in Syria. Maybe in the beginning they were coming Syrians, but now, because of the debate, because of all this discussion, because of all what has happened, then I think that a lot of people all around the world, in fact, all the people who want to come to Europe, and that's a large part of the population of the world who wants to come to Europe, they are actually seeing now that, oh, it is possible.
It's open.
It's not because they out of a sudden have a will to come to Europe. They have always had that will. Of course, we are a great civilization. We are rich. We are prosperous. We have everything, and they have not so much in where they come from, to say it diplomatically.
Yeah.
But of course, they want to come here, and you can understand that as a human being. But the problem is that now it's possible for them, and they see that it was also possible before, but now they see it. Now they know it is possible.
Yeah.
So now they have something. They have a goal. They have something to go away from, and that is important when so many people have to travel. And I think we can call it the phenomenon of the open doors policies. Because it is really a new phenomenon we have seen this year, that people can see that they can come here. And I think that we will see very, very huge consequences of this in a matter of very short time. We all know that this will continue also the next year, and then their families will come and so on. That would be that will be, of course, a huge problem, and will make things even worse in Europe. But that's only the beginning. We know from UN figures has recently told us that the population in Africa will, in the next 35 years, it will be doubled. And that is really something that we have to look into, because now people know that they can come to Europe if they push hard enough. They can break the fence, even in Hungary, I think so. And they will come. And there will come many. And there will come many from Arab countries, the Middle East, and so on. And very soon there will begin to come a lot of people from sub-Saharan countries, from Africa, and that will change everything so rapidly. I think that what we see now is that we don't know what is going to happen. Will we be a minority if this continues? Will we then be a minority in 50 years? For sure. But will we be it in 20 years or maybe even 15 years? We don't know. And that is really problematic. We really need to do something fast, quick.
Yes, now before it's too late. Exactly. Yeah. I think the projection number says about 4 billion Africans by the end of the century. That's a lot of people. And it's just so. Okay, let's talk about this a little bit here before we take a break in a few minutes here. But so, what do you what's your sense of things? How are things going to begin to play out here? How is the European people going to respond to this? Is it just gradually going to get, you know, worse and worse? I mean, we've already seen an explosion, of course, in rapes and crime and, you know, drug selling and everything else. Like, see, because a lot of these people, they do go underground, right? They come into the country, but they don't go the official route of like going on benefits and stuff. Or maybe they do, some of them. They do both, whatever. But part of that population that is coming in, it does things to survive that goes, you know, towards the black market or under the radar, which is selling drugs or, you know, prostitution or something. What do you see? What's going to happen here?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to project. But I think that we need as nationalists, we need to be very clear in our own minds about one thing, and that is that it is not really important how our countrymen's react. Yes, it is important, of course, but I don't think that we can rely on that they will react in a certain way due to these events that are happening. What have we seen in the last year? We have seen terror attacks. We have seen the massacre in Paris. We have seen the new year of Cologne. We have seen so many horrible things. And what have happened? Yeah, of course, people are angry and so on. But we have not really seen this revolutionary spirit that we need inside our people to get rid of this current system and establish a new one. We have not seen that yet.
It's not bad enough yet, right? We're still in the comfort zone. We still have a lot to lose, right?
I'm very cautious with saying that it's not bad enough yet, because I actually I'm not relying so much on that anymore. That things have to get worse and worse, and then things will happen. Because especially because we are in such a sensible situation, things will change very dramatically in a very short time, and we cannot wait, you know, for things to get worse, because things are already pretty shitty, to say it politely.
Yeah.
And I think that what is important in the next months, years, that is not the way the people react, because I don't think that they themselves will make dramatic changes unless they are offered a real alternative, and unless they are offered hope and trust in that we can really change some things. So I think it's more important how we react as nationalists, what we are going to do, what are we going to do with the things that are happening. And I'm not saying that parliamentarism is the only way. I think that there are many ways to seize our goal, which is the survival of our people. And for example, what we have seen in Stockholm with people on the streets defending their people, that could be a way to go. But I also see some problems with that. But it's really not my business, so I'm not. But that is also an alternative to offer to people. For my own sake, as a party leader, I think that it is important politically to show people that it's actually possible. For us now, we have not had, in modern time in Denmark, we have not had a real nationalist party who are running for the national parliament and so on. We are trying to do that now. First and foremost, I see it as important not to get some mandates or of which we can do anything. That's not the important thing. The important thing here is that this is also a way to make people believe in, oh, it's actually possible. First of all, if it's even possible for us to run for parliament, we need 20,000 signatures. It's quite a lot in a small country as Denmark. If we manage to get them, we are invited to all the debates, all the television stations who have debates between all the party leaders, they must also invite us. That's how things work in Denmark. So if we manage to do that, we will. I hope that that's the point of our work. I think we can inspire people, and we can say to people, it is possible to do something. We can still change things. So I think the important things, that is how we work. That is what we are going to do. That is the way we are going to try to give people hope and to make people trust in that we really can make some changes, and to emphasize this about it is only about political will. It is not about tools. It is not about measures. We don't like measures. We don't like tools. We can do everything. We are Europeans, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But it's about the will. And if we can make people trust that it is possible to change things, to have a triumph of the will, then things will change, I'm sure.
All right. There's a lot of things I do want to ask you about here when it comes to, you know, your strategy, your approach, how you see the media treatment of your party and yourself, et cetera, that we can save that, I think, for the second segment and get more into that and the needy and greedy. But let's just speak a bit about what people can do right now to help you guys out, right? You talked about that for a little bit, 20,000 signatures. That's really the next thing you want to do. What's your plan in terms of how to get people engaged? And if we have people listening, how can they help you out in this regard?
Yeah, first and foremost, right now we have started a new campaign, and first and foremost we are doing things online now, as we recently had a new system in Denmark where it's possible to gather these signatures online. That's of course a big help. And that makes things more easy. But 20,000 people is still a lot. And the method for doing this is still a bit bureaucratic. Actually, what we are doing now is that we are doing a lot of marketing online. We made recently a video commercial for Facebook, YouTube, and so on. And in 3-4 weeks, it has been seen by more than 120,000. That's quite a lot in Denmark. That's actually very, very, very good. But we are doing things like that, you know, commercials and so on. And we do what we can to, you know, appear professional, of course, to appeal to people, but also, you know, to make this this hope again, to give people this hope that it is really possible to organize something professional and good as an alternative to multiculturalism. So basically, what we need now is money. We don't have much money. We get only a very small amount from the state after our first election in 2013. But that's really about it. And of course, if we have Danish listeners, then of course they can go on into our website and give us a signature. That would be a great help, of course.
Tell us where they can go to do that.
We have a special website for that called stemdansk.dk, and. Yeah, on that website, you basically give your email to us, and then we register it and we send it to the ministry in Denmark. And after 1 week, you get an email with a link where you can approve your signature for us with your identity card, and that's about it.
Now, give us the spelling of that, just so we make sure everyone get it.
Yes, stemdansk .dk.
All right, very good. And then, of course, you do have danskenesparti.dk as well.
Yes.
We'll make sure to link this up and everything else. Because there's a lot of things here that I want to really get into the needy and greedy of and ask you more about. But I think we should take a little break here. But okay, that's good. Then people know how they can support you. And I mean, obviously, it's always boils down to the resources that you can put into it when it comes to the financial question, right? In terms of how much advertisement you can get, how you can get the message out, brochures, have people on the street. And is there any way you're open to volunteers and people who are concerned who can come to you and help you out to, you know, help things to hand things out or talk to people or something?
That is indeed possible, and they can contact us through our web page or our Facebook page. But mainly, I must say that the most of things we are doing in the street is talking to people. So there, yeah, things would be complicated when you don't speak Danish. But we also do a little bit of handing out flyers to households. We will begin with that in the next step of our campaign, which will begin very, very shortly. But until now, we have mostly done online advertising.
Very good. Yeah, I know we have a good chunk of good folks from Denmark listening. So definitely get involved, folks, and do help Daniel out and the Party of the Danes, because they do need your help. So definitely take that call, because you know what's at stake here, and you know that you have to do something. You can't just sit on your ass and expect everyone else to solve this for you. So do get involved.
And if we have some listeners who are good at graphics, videos, or things like that, that would also be interesting for us to hear from them. Maybe that would be a help that they could do from home.
Very good. Okay, excellent. Then you know, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, well, we'll take a short break here, and then we'll continue to talk more with Daniel Carlson right after this. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you. Our second hour is coming up with Daniel Carlson. We continue our conversation on a wide range of topics, from politics to metapolitics and how to encourage our cultural heritage and still be able to take a step into the future and not just keep looking back. We talk about the general attitudes of the media to the party. I ask a bit about Denmark's history and if there is an appreciation for the shared Germanic past that the Danish people have with the rest of us northern folks. We also talk about some of our most cherished northern celebrations, such as Midsummer, Lucia, and of course Yule. We discuss political and economic solutions to birth rates, the future, and consider what might be happening in regards to border enforcements and territory in the future. You know, it's not only about how to stop people from invading into the European continent and what kind of culture, mentality, and behavior that these people bring with them, but more importantly, how do we create a strong-minded and strong-willed individual that no matter what level of globalization, materialism, propaganda, and influence, still want to maintain who they are and have a strong bond and sense of belonging with their people and their own culture as a way to encourage human biodiversity and preserve the beauty of difference. When you want to hear more, go to redicemembers.com to sign up and tune in to this second segment coming up. We have a full archive of programs such as these and many more. Tons of guests and different subjects. So take a look in our archives. Over 1,000 shows coming up on 10 years here later this year. It's only €6 per month, by the way. And we have subscriptions from 3 months up to 2 years available. And it gets cheaper per month the longer you subscribe for, by the way. But €6 is about $6.60 at today's conversion rates, is about $9.20, $9.40, in case you're curious about some of the other currency rates. Anyway, I think you get the idea. For the price of a, well, fancy cup of coffee or a beer, only once a month, you can get access to our loaded members section with tons of important information that you need to arm yourself with. And of course, support us at the same time so we can continue to bring you these shows and also grow into the new fun stuff that we have planned for you. Upcoming, we have Bob Whitaker and Tom Bowie this Friday. Next Monday, we have Christopher Jun Bjerknes on his work on Einstein, the plagiarist. Fascinating show. And we have more in the queue after this. So that wraps up our first segment. Stay with us, everybody. Much more coming up after the break. RedIceMembers.com. We'll see you there. Thank you for listening.